Listening test, task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about TV technologies and formats. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
But it's happening all around the world, because these days TV is competing with YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, computer games, and the usual tablets and devices found in many homes. A generation is turning away from traditional TV. That has huge implications for the broadcast industry. Someone who's been at the cutting edge of it is Christoph Klimmer. His company, Xtreme, provides a platform for all kinds of TV production companies to stream shows online directly to the public. It's a service known as over-the-top or OTT because it bypasses traditional TV broadcasters, known in the industry as linear TV. So does he think the days of his counterparts in linear TV are numbered?
I think they have no choice but to accept and acknowledge the change of consumer habits, right? I mean, if you look at the numbers, we can, for example, see that the global revenue generated by OTT services are projected to double between 2015 and 2021. The OTT revenue grows 3 times faster compared to traditional linear TV.
And do you notice a change in the kind of content offered through the services that you develop compared to, say, traditional linear TV?
There is certainly a change. Streaming services in general are subject to a different consumer logic than traditional linear TV. Look at, for example, how they need to seek for the consumer's attention. On streaming services, what is probably much more relevant is content that is sticky. For example, content that binds the consumer to the service over a longer period of time. I think this is why, for example, the bigger players such as Netflix have such a strong focus on TV shows instead of movies, for example, or other formats, because TV shows trigger, you know, this binge-watching phenomenon. For example, Netflix has that infamous feature to skip the credits and just start the next episode right away. So I think in this regard, the uptake of streaming services actually played an integral role for what we today call the golden age of TV drama, with shows such as Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones. That will be interesting to see how that keeps on evolving and if this trend with these epic narratives over various seasons actually continues, or if the bigger players such as, again, Netflix and Amazon try to increase their share of this currency of the consumer attention by shorter or more focused formats such as mini drama series or reality formats, true crime and all that stuff.
Could you give me examples of clients that you've had and the different forms in which they've adapted traditional linear TV?
I think a good example is the client we have in India, a Bollywood studio, a production studio, Balaji, they're called. They produce soap operas that traditionally used to license the content to linear TV stations, to broadcasters. So they have now launched their own direct-to-consumer subscription service on the back of our platform, actually, and that allows them to address a different, younger demographic with content that would never make it on Indian TV, for example.
Why wouldn't it make it on Indian TV?
So there are, for example, narratives around ambiguous historical characters or homoerotic love affairs.
Mera beta Rosie se pyar karta hai.
Kaun se planet pe ho aap dono?
Are you kidding?
Kisne aapse kuch kaha kya? Actually, I can explain to you.
I like men.
It's too edgy for Indian TV. Also, for example, stories around identity struggles of feminists. So content that is not targeted to a, let's say, a traditional audience of linear TV, but addresses really the young, educated audience that is also tech savvy and has a different educational background.
So they can target a more narrow niche audience, you're saying?
Exactly, because the cost to actually launch such a service is, compared to a linear TV station, it's marginal, right? So they can be much more flexible in addressing niches that they deem relevant for their business. They can target new audiences.
So it sounds like your service, the technology, is opened this kind of medium to much more experimentation when it comes to content. Is that what you're finding?
That is true. I can only confirm that. It's easier for companies to distribute the content that they either produce themselves or maybe license in, and that opens up opportunities for new players, smaller players, creative players, niche players to build their own brand through a video streaming service.
But it's happening all around the world, because these days TV is competing with YouTube, Netflix, Amazon, computer games, and the usual tablets and devices found in many homes. A generation is turning away from traditional TV. That has huge implications for the broadcast industry. Someone who's been at the cutting edge of it is Christoph Klimmer. His company, Xstream, provides a platform for all kinds of TV production companies to stream shows online directly to the public. It's a service known as over-the-top or OTT because it bypasses traditional TV broadcasters, known in the industry as linear TV. So does he think the days of his counterparts in linear TV are numbered?
I think they have no choice but to accept and acknowledge the change of consumer habits, right? I mean, if you look at the numbers, we can, for example, see that the global revenue generated by OTT services are projected to double between 2015 and 2021. The OTT revenue grows three times faster compared to traditional linear TV.
And do you notice a change in the kind of content offered through the services that you develop compared to, say, traditional linear TV?
There is certainly a change. Streaming services in general are subject to a different consumer logic than traditional linear TV. Look at, for example, how they need to seek for the consumer's attention. On streaming services, what is probably much more relevant is content that is sticky. For example, content that binds the consumer to the service over a longer period of time. I think this is why, for example, the bigger players such as Netflix have such a strong focus on TV shows instead of movies, for example, or other formats, because TV shows trigger, you know, this binge-watching phenomenon. For example, Netflix has that infamous feature to skip the credits and just start the next episode right away. So I think in this regard, the uptake of streaming services actually played an integral role for what we today call the golden age of TV drama, with shows such as Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones. That will be interesting to see how that keeps on evolving and if this trend with these epic narratives over various seasons actually continues, or if the bigger players such as, again, Netflix and Amazon try to increase their share of this currency of the consumer attention by shorter or more focused formats such as mini drama series or reality formats, true crime and all that stuff.
Could you give me examples of clients that you've had and the different forms in which they've adapted traditional linear TV?
I think a good example is a client we have in India, a Bollywood studio, a production studio, Balaji, they're called. They produce soap operas that traditionally used to license the content to linear TV stations, to broadcasters. So they have now launched their own direct-to-consumer subscription service on the back of our platform, actually. And that allows them to address a different, younger demographic with content that would never make it on Indian TV,
Why wouldn't it make it on Indian TV?
So there are, for example, narratives around ambiguous historical characters or homoerotic love affairs.
Mera beta Rosie se pyar karta hai.
Kaun se planet pe ho aap dono?
Aiyoo, kis ke rab
mein rehte
hai? Kisne aapse kuch kaha kya? Actually, I can explain to you.
I like men.
It's too edgy for Indian TV. Also, for example, stories around identity struggles of feminists. So content that is not targeted to a, let's say, a traditional audience of linear TV, but addresses really the young, educated audience that is also tech savvy and has a different educational background.
So they can target a more narrow niche audience, you're saying?
Exactly, because the cost to actually launch such a service is, compared to a linear TV station, it's marginal, right? So they can be much more flexible in addressing niches that they deem relevant for their business. They can target new audiences.
So it sounds like your service, the technology, is opened this kind of medium to much more experimentation when it comes to content. Is that what you're finding?
That is true. I can only confirm that. It's easier for companies to distribute the content that they either produce themselves or maybe license in, and that opens up opportunities for new players, smaller players, creative players, niche players to build their own brand through a video streaming service.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording from 2017 about universal basic income. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
It sounds somewhat utopian, but social scientists, technologists, and politicians from across the political spectrum think they have a potential solution to the unemployment that automation and artificial intelligence are expected to create. It's called a universal basic income, and it involves getting the state to pay a fixed sum to all its citizens, regardless of whether they have a job or not. This week, the Canadian province of Ontario became the latest authority to trial a basic income with 4,000 households. Kathleen Wynne is the province's premier.
The changing nature of work is leaving some people vulnerable. They're working contract to contract, or they're otherwise dealing with an unstable or precarious work situation. They can be let go with no warning. As a result, some people can slip into poverty. Now, if that happens, what's the best way to help people manage or endure this uncertainty and give them the opportunity to succeed over the long term? Is it our current system of social assistance, or is there a better way? For months, we've been working together, doing the background work to explore the idea of a basic income. And today, I'm pleased to announce the details of Ontario's basic income pilot that we'll be launching here in the Hamilton area and in two other Ontario communities, Lindsay and the Thunder Bay area. It's a great thing.
Well, in Finland, a basic income pilot is already underway, but it's controversial. The BBC's Paul Moss went there to find out more.
They've done a good job renovating the centre of Tampere. This old industrial city in the south of Finland was once blighted by dilapidated, disused factories and warehouses. Now they've been turned into cafes and shopping malls. But there's no hiding the fact that along with Tampere's industrial decline has come high unemployment and a loss of skilled jobs in particular. It was in Tampere's one-time industrial heartland that I met Mikko Rusinen. He'd been without a job for 2 years when he got a letter from the Finnish government telling him he'd been selected for a new experiment. Instead of getting unemployment benefit, Mika would receive a fixed basic income from the state of 560 euros a month, his to keep even if he managed to find work and earn other money.
When I first got my letter that I got a basic income, I was very excited. You can accept low-paid jobs or part-time jobs and you still get the basic income. But the best part is that it gives you security. You can try something different. Start your own enterprise, take training. You still got some money, still got the basic income.
Having a basic income provided by the state was once the sort of idea put forward only by more left-wing economists, certainly something usually considered by think tanks or university seminars, perhaps. But now there are proposals to try out the basic income in parts of France, the Netherlands, and in the city of Glasgow. Meanwhile, here in Finland, it's a centre-right government which decided to randomly select 2,000 unemployed men and women and pay them a fixed sum. And in keeping with traditional Nordic sober thinking, they insist the experiment has no particular ideological underpinning. It's simply a matter of seeing if it works.
We need to know whether the basic income, the mechanism in the social security, will activate people to take on jobs more easily than now, or will they get lazy and stay at home?
Marjukka Turunen is helping to run the basic income experiment.
It sounds somewhat utopian, but social scientists, technologists, and politicians from across the political spectrum think they have a potential solution to the unemployment that automation and artificial intelligence are expected to create. It's called a universal basic income, and it involves getting the state to pay a fixed sum to all its citizens, regardless of whether they have a job or not. This week, the Canadian province of Ontario became the latest authority to trial a basic income with 4,000 households. Kathleen Wynne is the province's premier.
The changing nature of work is leaving some people vulnerable. They're working contract to contract, or they're otherwise dealing with an unstable or precarious work situation. They can be let go with no warning. As a result, some people can slip into poverty. Now, if that happens, what's the best way to help people manage or endure this uncertainty and give them the opportunity to succeed over the long term? Is it our current system of social assistance, or is there a better way? For months, we've been working together, doing the background work to explore the idea of a basic income. And today, I'm pleased to announce the details of Ontario's basic income pilot that we'll be launching here in the Hamilton area and in two other Ontario communities, Lindsay and the Thunder Bay area. It's a great thing.
Well, in Finland, a basic income pilot is already underway, but it's controversial. The BBC's Paul Moss went there to find out more.
They've done a good job renovating the centre of Tampere. This old industrial city in the south of Finland was once blighted by dilapidated, disused factories and warehouses. Now they've been turned into cafes and shopping malls. But there's no hiding the fact that along with Tampere's industrial decline has come high unemployment and a loss of skilled jobs in particular. It was in Tampere's one-time industrial heartland that I met Mikko Rusinen. He'd been without a job for 2 years when he got a letter from the Finnish government telling him he'd been selected for a new experiment. Instead of getting unemployment benefit, Mika would receive a fixed basic income from the state of 560 euros a month, his to keep even if he managed to find work and earn other money.
When I first got my letter that I got a basic income, I was very excited. You can accept low-paid jobs or part-time jobs and you still get the basic income. But the best part is that it gives you security. You can try something different. Start your own enterprise, take training. You still got some money, still got the basic income.
Having a basic income provided by the state was once the sort of idea put forward only by more left-wing economists, certainly something usually considered by think tanks or university seminars, perhaps. But now there are proposals to try out the basic income in parts of France, the Netherlands, and in the city of Glasgow. Meanwhile, here in Finland, it's a centre-right government which decided to randomly select 2,000 unemployed men and women and pay them a fixed sum. And in keeping with traditional Nordic sober thinking, they insist the experiment has no particular ideological underpinning. It's simply a matter of seeing if it works.
We need to know whether the basic income, the mechanism in the social security, will activate people to take on jobs more easily than now, or will they get lazy and stay at home?
Marjukka Turunen is helping to run the basic income experiment.
Task 3. You are going to listen to experts talking about a new type of school. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 6 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Today, the MacArthur Foundation, the people who give out the Genius Grants, announced it is funding a new public school in New York. The MacArthur Foundation also gives financial support to NPR. The school is going to be for 6th through 12th graders, and the curriculum for the whole school will center around designing video games. As Heather Chaplin reports, the MacArthur Foundation is throwing its support and $1.1 million behind a new idea about what it means to be literate in the 21st century. It's called gaming literacy.
Let's say it's 1830 and you're a farmer. You make sure your son can read and write so that he can understand the deed to his land and sign contracts. He is literate. Today, literacy is more complicated. The MacArthur Foundation's Director of Educational Grantmaking, Connie Yao, believes one of the keys to 21st century literacy can be found in video games.
It's not just games, but gaming as a way of interacting is so important for the future.
Yao recommended to MacArthur that it fund a school of game design, and she went for help to Katie Salen, the director of the Game Lab Institute of Play in New York City. Salen has been experimenting with teaching game design to kids.
Okay. So you felt it was too hard. Yeah. And would you have suggestions about how to fix that? Yeah, one sec.
We changed the hero to a shooting hero.
Salen can't get over how enthusiastic the kids in her game design classes are. But the energy in Salen's classroom is about more than just games being fun. Salen's preparing her students to go beyond 20th century literacy, which was about memorizing information from a textbook.
What we needed to know was in that book, and if we mastered what was in that book, we would be set.
Today, it's not so much about knowing the exact content on page 309, but it's understanding how the content on page 309 might be connected to content on page 500, which then may be impacted by something that you find elsewhere on the web.
Juggling lots of different connected elements is a big part of what you're doing when you design a game.
Gaming provides a really interesting frame for looking at the world and kind of parsing what we might call the operating system of the world in this way. And so we call that kind of gaming literacy.
Gaming literacy teaches kids about dynamic systems. Take the new Super Mario Brothers. As Mario, you're chasing the evil Bowser and his evil son. The game has 80 levels spread across 8 interconnected worlds. Grab the micro mushroom and you become so small you fall down a tiny hole into a new level. Grab the mega mushroom and your Mario becomes so big he can grab coins right out of the sky. That's a dynamic system in motion, in a game. For a real-world example, take climate change. You drive your car, it contributes to the release of carbon dioxide into the air, which contributes to global warming, which in turn makes the polar ice caps in Alaska melt, which means the polar bears who live there no longer have anywhere to live. This means your car is connected to those polar bears half a continent away. That's also a dynamic system in motion. The World Wide Web is a dynamic system, the global economy is a dynamic system, your ATM is a dynamic system, the weather, a corporation, all things you need to understand to be literate in the 21st century.
Today, the MacArthur Foundation, the people who give out the genius grants, announced it is funding a new public school in New York. The MacArthur Foundation also gives financial support to NPR. The school is going to be for 6th through 12th graders, and the curriculum for the whole school will center around designing video games. As Heather Chaplin reports, the MacArthur Foundation is throwing its support and $1.1 million behind a new idea about what it means to be literate in the 21st century. It's called gaming literacy.
Let's say it's 1830 and you're a farmer. You make sure your son can read and write so that he can understand the deed to his land and sign contracts. He is literate. Today, literacy is more complicated. The MacArthur Foundation's Director of Educational Grantmaking, Connie Yao, believes one of the keys to 21st century literacy can be found in video games.
It's not just games, but gaming as a way of interacting is so important for the future.
Yao recommended to MacArthur that it fund a school of game design, and she went for help to Katie Salen, the director of the Game Lab Institute of Play in New York City. Salen has been experimenting with teaching game design to kids.
Okay. So you felt it was too hard. Yeah. And would you have suggestions about how to fix that?
We changed the hero to a shooting hero.
Salen can't get over how enthusiastic the kids in her game design classes are. But the energy in Salen's classroom is about more than just games being fun. Salen's preparing her students to go beyond 20th century literacy, which was about memorizing information from a textbook.
What we needed to know was in that book, and if we mastered what was in that book, we would be set. Today, it's not so much about knowing the exact content on page 309, but it's understanding how the content on page 309 might be connected to content on page 500, which then may be impacted by something that you find elsewhere on the web.
Juggling lots of different connected elements is a big part of what you're doing when you design a game.
Gaming provides a really interesting frame for looking at the world and kind of parsing what we might call the operating system of the world in this way. And so we call that kind of gaming literacy.
Gaming literacy teaches kids about dynamic systems. Take the new Super Mario Brothers. As Mario, you're chasing the evil Bowser and his evil son. The game has 80 levels spread across 8 interconnected worlds. Grab the micro mushroom and you become so small you fall down a tiny hole into a new level. Grab the mega mushroom and your Mario becomes so big he can grab coins right out of the sky. That's a dynamic system in motion, in a game. For a real-world example, take climate change. You drive your car, it contributes to the release of carbon dioxide into the air, which contributes to global warming, which in turn makes the polar ice caps in Alaska melt, which means the polar bears who live there no longer have anywhere to live. This means your car is connected to those polar bears half a continent away. That's also a dynamic system in motion, The World Wide Web is a dynamic system. The global economy is a dynamic system. Your ATM is a dynamic system. The weather, a corporation, all things you need to understand to be literate in the 21st century.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about a proposed tunnel under Stonehenge. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 8 with the sentence endings A to K. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Tomorrow morning, Stonehenge will again be alive with revellers celebrating the summer solstice. Highways England are warning people using the A303, the road which passes so close to Stonehenge that you can actually see the monument from your car, to expect delays. Mind you, as locals know all too well, delays on the A303 are nothing unusual. The question of how to ease traffic flow along it, without wrecking the supreme icon of British prehistory, is one that has been perplexing archaeologists and transport planners for decades. It was in the 1980s that the idea of a Stonehenge tunnel was first raised. Then, in 2014, a 2.9-kilometre-long tunnel was included in the government's official road strategy. Budgeted at £200 million, it would sink the A303 underground. Earlier this year, the plans were put out to public consultation. Job done then, you might think. Well, perhaps not. Last week, a report to the UNESCO World Heritage Committee raised reservations about the plan. At issue, archaeology. When a tunnel was first suggested back in the 80s, the focus of archaeologists' concerns was Stonehenge itself, the actual stones. Now, though, archaeologists understand that Stonehenge makes no sense unless it is studied in the context of the 26 square miles of the UNESCO World Heritage Site, which surrounds it. Inevitably, this in turn has implications for the government's plans for a tunnel. Many archaeologists think that the tunnel as planned isn't long enough, and that both the entrances to it, the portals, and the approach roads will have a devastating impact on the prehistoric landscape. Historic England, which will pass judgment on the final plans, is less worried. We'll hear from them in a moment, but Making History wanted to know what other specialists thought.
My name's Rosemary Hill. I've written a history of Stonehenge. If you build a tunnel, you will be making the biggest man-made intervention in Salisbury Plain in a World Heritage Site that has ever been made. And I very much doubt whether future generations will forgive us for that.
I'm Barry Cunliffe, Emeritus Professor of European Archaeology at Oxford University. And I've been involved with trying to improve the Stonehenge landscape since the early 1970s. I would go very firmly in favour of the tunnel. It gets the road out of the way, and for the first time, It reunites the Stonehenge landscape. My only concern is that we get the entrances to the tunnels right, so that they're not intrusive and that they don't destroy any of the wonderful sight lines that you can have in that landscape.
Professor Sir Barry Cunliffe and Rosemary Hill. Well, Making History's Helen Castor has been to Salisbury Plain to test the waters and to find out what archaeologists and heritage managers think about the Stonehenge Tunnel. First, dodging heavy showers, Professor David Jakes from the University of Buckingham takes us to a site as little known as it is rich with archaeological discoveries. Blickmead, a mile from the Stone Circle and directly adjacent to where the eastern portal of the proposed tunnel would be built, offers a glimpse, so David Jakes believes, into the very beginnings of Stonehenge.
To the untrained eye, this looks like a scruffy backwater. It's the sort of place that people might throw their old tyres. To the trained eye, it's really fascinating because we actually have the edge of the old River Avon here and this spring complex, which has been almost like a type of natural museum for artefacts going back to the end of the Ice Age. We have the longest range of hunter-gatherer radiocarbon dates for Western Europe here. We've discovered the communities who built the first monuments at Stonehenge.
Tomorrow morning, Stonehenge will again be alive with revellers celebrating the summer solstice. Highways England are warning people using the A303, the road which passes so close to Stonehenge that you can actually see the monument from your car, to expect delays. Mind you, as locals know all too well, delays on the A303 are nothing unusual. The question of how to ease traffic flow along it, without wrecking the supreme icon of British prehistory, is one that has been perplexing archaeologists and transport planners for decades. It was in the 1980s that the idea of a Stonehenge tunnel was first raised. Then, in 2014, a 2.9-kilometre-long tunnel was included in the government's official road strategy. Budgeted at £200 million, it would sink the A303 underground. Earlier this year, the plans were put out to public consultation. Job done, then, you might think. Well, perhaps not. Last week, a report to the UNESCO World Heritage Committee raised reservations about the plan. At issue, archaeology. When a tunnel was first suggested back in the 80s, the focus of archaeologists' concerns was Stonehenge itself, the actual stones. Now, though, archaeologists understand that Stonehenge makes no sense unless it is studied in the context of the 26 square miles of the UNESCO World Heritage Site, which surrounds it. Inevitably, this in turn has implications for the government's plans for a tunnel. Many archaeologists think that the tunnel as planned isn't long enough, and that both the entrances to it, the portals, and the approach roads will have a devastating impact on the prehistoric landscape. Historic England, which will pass judgment on the final plans, is less worried. We'll hear from them in a moment, but Making History wanted to know what other specialists thought.
My name's Rosemary Hill. I've written a history of Stonehenge. If you build a tunnel, you will be making the biggest man-made intervention in Salisbury Plain in a World Heritage Site that has ever been made. And I very much doubt whether future generations will forgive us for that.
I'm Barry Cunliffe, Emeritus Professor of European Archaeology at Oxford University. And I've been involved with trying to improve the Stonehenge landscape since the early 1970s. I would go very firmly in favour of the tunnel. It gets the road out of the way, and for the first time, it reunites the Stonehenge landscape. My only concern is that we get the entrances to the tunnels right, so that they're not intrusive and that they don't destroy any of the wonderful sight lines that you can have in that landscape.
Professor Sir Barry Cunliffe and Rosemary Hill. Well, Making History's Helen Castor has been to Salisbury Plain to test the waters and to find out what archaeologists and heritage managers think about the Stonehenge Tunnel. First, dodging heavy showers, Professor David Jakes from the University of Buckingham takes us to a site as little known as it is rich with archaeological discoveries. Blickmead, A mile from the stone circle, and directly adjacent to where the eastern portal of the proposed tunnel would be built, offers a glimpse, so David Jakes believes, into the very beginnings of Stonehenge.
To the untrained eye, this looks like a scruffy backwater. It's the sort of place that people might throw their old tyres. To the trained eye, it's really fascinating because we actually have the edge of the old River Avon here and this spring complex, which has been almost like a type of natural museum for artefacts going back to the end of the Ice Age. We have the longest range of hunter-gatherer radiocarbon dates for Western Europe here. We've discovered the communities who built the first monuments at Stonehenge.
This is the end of the listening test.